Hi, I'm Perry, and you're listening to The Beauty Brains. Hello, and welcome to The Beauty Brains, a show where real cosmetic chemists answer your beauty product questions and give you an insider's look at the cosmetic industry. This is episode 354. I'm your host, Perry Romanowski, and with me today is Valerie George. Hello, Valerie.
Hi, Perry.
Hey, Valerie, we have a great show today. On today's show, we're going to cover some questions that were sent in, including: what is our opinion about microneedle patches? How do we know that a study can be trusted? What makes a hair conditioner condition? Is EFG, epidermal growth factor, worth the hype? And why do companies include lots of ingredients in their formulas that they just don't talk about? But before we get to those questions and the news, Valerie, a little bit of our famous chit-chat. How's it going?
I am hanging out in this Arctic vortex that is happening in the United States right now. It's very cold in some parts. It's only about 23 degrees for the high here today, Fahrenheit. Coming from California, my blood is so thin, I cannot handle this cold.
Yeah, well, you know, if I were in Chicago right now, it would also be cold and snowy. But I am in a new country, Antigua. I had a trip planned with my brother-in-law and a couple other friends, and we're just here hanging out in the warm, sunny weather right by the ocean.
Well, you sent me some photos. It is stunning there.
Yeah, it's very nice. I always love coming to a warm place during the winter. What I don't love are the ton of bug bites that I have on my legs. How do I forget to use bug spray when I come to these things?
Especially because you get so many bug bites. They love your blood.
I know. I mean, I must have 3 dozen bug bites right now. And I'm trying not to itch them while I'm talking here. But you know what? The thing that's the worst, none of my friends have any bug bites.
Really?
Yeah. I'm the only one who gets them all. I don't
know. Oh, you must be getting all of them. That's why you have so many.
I guess so. I do not know. Why am I particularly singled out by these insects? I guess they just like the sweet nectar of my own blood, I suppose.
The sweet nectar. I bet you there's a study for that online.
There should be. I'll have to look this up. I wonder if anybody out there in Beauty Brain's audience has afflicted by bug bites as much as I am when they come to the Caribbean.
You know, I have a friend that's a hematologist, which is a blood doctor, so maybe they would know. Or maybe they'll be annoyed with my persistent questions.
Well, we'll double back on the next show. All right, we ready for some beauty science news?
Yeah, I think we kind of saw some of the same stuff this week.
Yeah, I saw this study. Well, it's not a study. I just saw this news report, and I wanted to talk about it because, you know, it's about there's a skincare craze that has hit tweens, but is actually worth it? That's the question. And so basically what's happening is people are going on TikTok. Influencers are telling teenagers and preteens that they need to do stuff for their skin. And so these kids are going to Sephora and spending all kinds of money. And this article just looked at it and said, hey, do kids really need to do this skincare stuff? And I'm just looking at it, I'm like, no, this is ridiculous. Why are kids doing skincare like this? But maybe that's just my perspective. What do you think of this?
Well, first of all, when I was growing up, my parents would have never given me enough money, I should say, right, to go buy these skincare products. I was lucky if I could get a dollar for lunch when I was growing up. But anyway, I saw some things on the internet, YouTube, TikTok. People are outraged that these 10, 11, 12, 13-year-olds are going into Sephora, some people even younger, and they're just going crazy in the store, making a big mess, and honestly making it an undesirable shopping experience. You know, people go to Sephora because they have premium and prestige beauty care, and then a 10-year-old is ransacking a sample and, you know, then snatching some stuff up to buy it. So, you know, downgrades the shopping experience a little bit.
I totally could see that. But, you know, they have kids buying stuff with retinol and vitamin C, and the marketers are trying to play this off as it's, you know, you don't really need it now, but your skin's going to be better in the future if it was trained earlier. And I just do not buy that. There's no evidence that says that. And, you know, kids don't need these anti-aging skincare products, do they?
I especially don't think they need the exfoliating acids, the retinoids. These are really hardcore things that increase cellular turnover. And while I don't have peer-reviewed literature for this, I would like to think that this excessive increased skin turnover would actually predispose your skin to more premature aging than if you didn't do those at all. Like your skin just doesn't need that, because when you're 10, 11, 12, 13, or even 18, your skin is performing optimally. Do you need some sun protection? Sure. Should you wash and gently exfoliate your face every once in a while? Sure. But you don't need these heavy, aggressive actives.
Yeah, I would agree. I think, you know, kids should be wearing sunscreen if they're going out in the sun. And, you know, okay, cleansing your face is all right. But to get onto like a 17-step skincare routine when you're like 8 or 9 years old, it just seems ridiculous to me. And I think it's like bad for your future mindset about taking care of your skin anyway. It sounds like a lot of work.
I only wore sunscreen when I was younger, and here I am. People think I'm in my 30s, and I'm not. No. My young 30s, I would point out.
Well, you know, I grew up in the 1970s, and your sunscreen was to stay out in the sun until it burned so much that it hurt too much to go out more in the sun. So that was back before they knew that you should do, you know, sunscreen was a thing you should do, right?
Yeah, tanning was thought to be healthy.
Yeah, so. But fortunately, we got smarter. All right. Well, since I am on vacation, why don't we head right on over to the questions and, you know, get this show rolling. The first question comes to us from one of our patrons, Rebecca. She says, "Hi, Beauty Brains, longtime listener here. I'm interested in your opinion on microneedle patches. Is there any evidence that they help skincare ingredients perform better or reach further into the skin? The ones that I've seen have dissolving spikes. Now, I've listened to episode 135, so that is pre-Valerie episode.
There. In fact, today is our 199th episode together.
Wow. Okay, well, this episode was, I guess Randy and I must have spoken about microneedles and got my opinion, and she wanted to know, is Perry's opinion, has it changed? And what does Valerie think of microneedles? So I think my opinion must have been that, it sounds like a marketing gimmick. And I don't think that my opinion, at least as far as it's applied to skincare products, has changed much. I haven't seen any evidence that using microneedles for anti-aging actives is going to provide any additional benefit that can't be gotten other ways through topical skincare.
Well, it's funny you say that, Perry, because I disagree, and I'm sure the audience is not surprised to hear this. But I just feel like if anything comes from the pharmacological world, which these microneedle patches are used for drug delivery, right? I feel like there just has to be a little something extra going on in the skin. In fact, in the Journal of Cosmetic Dermatology in 2017, there was a study, maybe you'll like it, maybe you won't, where they looked at the delivery of cosmetic actives to skin, specifically a skin whitening product. And what they did is they loaded a microneedle patch with the skin essence, whitening skin essence, and then on the other cheek, they only applied the skin essence by itself. And at 4 and 8 weeks, skin brightness and melanin indexes in both were improved. And so you might be saying, well, if they're both improved, why do you need the patch? Well, the patch did significantly better, but both still worked. So right. I guess it would be, do you need the patch? In this case, probably not. Did it help a little extra? Yeah. And there's a couple studies like this, one with increased moisture content with hyaluronic acid. So I wouldn't be like totally dismissive, but can you still get benefit without it? probably.
Yeah, and I saw the study that you were referencing, and I look, it's from 2017, so that was, what, 7 years ago?
Yeah.
I just look at sometimes the market forces, too. If the benefit was so great, why don't we see that more on the market? Because it would, if the benefit was so great, then people would start using it more. But there's got to be something that's happening there, right?
This is a very valid point. True. I'll tell you a couple reasons why I think these patches are a little harder to bring to the marketplace, or why brands aren't doing them. The first is it's a very specific manufacturing setup. You have to go to the very few handful of places that do it. They're typically in Asia. So that's the first barrier to entry. Is not necessarily, you know, nothing about Asia. I know we've talked about it before, but
Sure. The
barrier is it's across the world. It's a different language, different time zones, and to try to develop a product is very tough. Secondly, there are a couple brands that are doing microneedle patching very well, especially for acne. And the pricing is very low because I think these patches are somewhat affordable in the grand scheme of things.
Right.
So I think it's a little bit saturated of a marketplace. Thirdly, I would say the MOQ can be a little bit high. So for example, with a skincare, you can go get 500 pieces made, or you could go get 50,000 pieces made. With these patches, the MOQs tend to be like 25,000 to 30,000, which is a lot for most brands to bring to market. And
so
finally,
MOQ for the audience out there, minimum ordering quantity.
So you have to buy 25,000 to 30,000, right?
Yeah.
At a minimum, and I'm guessing in my experience. But also, the last point I want to make is, since 2017, a lot of brands have been really focused on sustainability and low-waste packaging. And these patch systems, you know, the patch has to be made. It has to go in a little tray, in a wrapper, in a box that's wrapped. That's, you know, it's just a lot of stuff surrounding the patch from a packaging perspective. And so I think people, at least when I've talked with brands about them, they'll say, well, you know, I'd love to do it, but it just seems like, you know, our customers are interested in not so much packaging waste. So I think there's a bunch of reasons. And, you know, efficacy probably plays a role in it as well. Like, people are enjoying and getting results from their skincare products. So,
yeah. And I also think, like, the patch, it's, how does that even going to work? You're not going to be able to put it on your whole face, right?
Exactly. That's the other
thing. So, yeah. So I guess it's more complicated than just rubbing a cream on. And if the cream's giving you benefits and the patch is only giving you a little bit more benefit, that could be a sort of an explanation of that too.
Yeah, you make an excellent point. The patch really is almost kind of limited to spot treatments.
Right. Exactly. So
unless you had a patch the shape of your face. That's an idea out there.
I'm seeing a microneedle facial mask, right?
Yeah. Well, then, too, the other point is you can go get microneedling at a spa.
Right. Yeah. There you go. So I think we talked about this. So we got Valerie's opinion. We got Perry's opinion. Maybe I'm a little softer on my opinion there. You've
convinced
me a little bit.
Than before. I like it. Look at you. You're warming up. But you're becoming fuzzy and warm in your more mature years.
Speaking of fuzzy and warm, why don't we move on to Lisa's audio question?
Hi, Perry and Valerie. Thank you so much for all you do to inform the masses and make sure that we have accurate information. I am so very grateful for this, and I have learned so much from your podcasts and some of your webinars. I just have a quick question. First of all, I am a recovering clean beauty formulator, and the reason I got into clean beauty was because of the quote-unquote studies that villainized traditional cosmetic chemistry using synthetic chemicals. Many of your podcasts take time to debunk studies from the EWG or similar sites, which is fabulous, but I'm wondering, what are the hallmarks of a trustworthy study? How do I know that the information that I'm reading in any given study can be trusted? Thank you so much for answering my question, and I so look forward to your answer. Bye.
Well, thanks for that question, Lisa. This is a pretty good one, huh, Valerie?
It is. And we talk about this, not this specific topic per se, but sprinkled in here and there. We always talk about on the show, like, how do you know whether or not you can believe something?
Yeah. And the consumers are inundated with all kinds of information. Social media makes it so easy to get any kind of information out there. And if you're following the right people, that's good. If you're following the less right people, that can be bad because there's a lot of misinformation out there also. So how do you know that a study can be trustworthy? I think the first is you look is where is it published? Is it a reputable journal? Is it indexed by PubMed? That will give you more faith that it's more believable. If it's just published on somebody's blog, it doesn't necessarily mean it's wrong, but it probably isn't quite right.
Well, I think the great thing about peer-reviewed literature is that it's gone through a process, and some things get through. Like Nature has published a couple things where I'm like, whoa, slow your roll, Nature. That's not cool that you did that.
Well, also, if you look at the peer review process, you know, I've been a peer reviewer. Nobody's paying me to do this. And, you know, they just editors are sending out articles or like, oh, who do we know could read this? And it's a long article. And, you know, you have to make some assumptions that the people doing the studies did reasonable things. And so I can understand how something could slip through peer review if you're not looking at every detail and you're really knowledgeable about what they were doing.
Exactly. But on the contrary to peer-reviewed literature are these open access journals. And on one hand, I really enjoy open access journals because they're free. Anyone can go to these journals and take a look at them and get the information, whereas most of the journals like JAMA and even the International Journal of Cosmetic Science or the Journal of Cosmetic Science, these are paid journals. You have to either have access or purchase each article, right?
It's right.
A little bit, if you just want to peek into a study and see what happened, it's a little difficult. So these open access journals, you know, may seem great because it's like, oh, this information's free, these scientists are publishing it. The downside with an open access journal is anybody could be publishing
right.
these things, and no one is challenging this scientist's thought system or set of experiments before it gets published. And so when you see something like that, you have to say, this is great, but also take it with a grain of salt, knowing that it necessarily didn't go through a strict review process.
That's true. Now, we see studies published all the time. And one of my criticisms with some studies is that it's published by people who don't really know the industry. And so the famous study that looked at parabens and whether there is a problem with them, they looked at parabens in breast cancer. They found some in the controls, so it really wasn't correlated with breast cancer per se. But the thing about that study that I found a bit ridiculous was that it was hypothesizing that parabens in their deodorants were getting into breast tissue and that was causing problems. The problem is that deodorants don't typically use parabens, so it was not even a smart study. But
yeah.
The person doing it, they didn't know about cosmetics, really. And so they just thought they knew or something. I don't know. And that happens a lot with researchers, academic researchers, trying to do cosmetic stuff without knowing how cosmetics are put together, even.
That collaboration is really important. That's a great point. The other thing, and I always say this, if someone is giving you a piece of information, it doesn't matter where you are in life. It could be this literature that you're looking at. It could be someone on Instagram. You have to think, who is this person and what are their qualifications? Someone may look like an expert scientist online, but at the end of the day, they might not have any industry experience and they just may be really great at communicating. So who are they and why are they telling me this information? What's their agenda? What do they have to gain from sharing this? Is it non-biased? Is it their viewpoint? If you look at the paraben researcher and that article, you have to say, okay, what does this person have to gain by telling me this? Or what's their motive? Who's funding the study? That's another big important one. Wow. And when you look at her work, you know, she seems to be really interested and focused on showing that this material is really bad for us, right? It certainly doesn't seem unbiased. A lot of the other challenges with skincare studies is that usually they're industry funded or they're funded by an ingredient supplier. Remember the other week, Perry, we had the question about tetrahexyldecyl ascorbate and acetyl zingarone and stabilizing it. And I'm like, I can't believe they're slamming an ingredient they sell to sell another ingredient. It's like, you know, but if you didn't know the people in the tagline of who wrote the paper, you wouldn't know that they have this agenda to sell you this ingredient. You would think, oh, wow, they just made this discovery.
That's so true. But I want to get back to that notion that the research that is funded. And if you look at in the beauty industry, you look at especially skincare, anti-aging stuff, all of that research is kind of motivated research because nobody is publishing the study that says, oh, you know, I looked at this ingredient and nothing happened. And so
I wonder how much of that there is.
Right. There's definitely a ton of it. So I think they call it the file drawer effect, where if you start a research study and you can't show positive results, you just throw it in your desk drawer and it never comes out again. So everything that you see published has a bias towards positivity or towards proving that something is true, even though it might not be true or the evidence might not even be relevant. So many things, and we're going to talk about this later, but so many ingredients are put on the top of the skin. And in the lab, they were able to show that on a cell petri dish, it affected the cells. But if it never gets down to the cells, is it really doing anything? And that's the kind of research you find. And that's published in peer-reviewed research, too. So it does make it harder to know what you can trust. But let's get to what can we trust, Valerie?
Well, just in general, I think you can kind of... To say you can kind of trust everything is a bit loose. I mean, I certainly go into every paper with an open mind.
Right.
And I look at it. And if I can answer the questions, who did the research, who funded it, and why are they telling me this information? And I cannot be repulsed by it. I can trust it a little bit more. And two, I can also use some common sense and scientific reasoning, whether or not something seems real when you look at the study design. That's how I trust it.
And I also think if you look at the size of a company that's putting out products with an ingredient, it's probably more trustworthy coming from a bigger company than from a smaller internet startup that just put up a web page and talks about an ingredient. So that's only like a heuristic. That's not necessarily going to always be true. But it's probably more true that a big company has at least done some research behind an ingredient, and you can kind of trust it more. Having said that, they are also motivated to get you to buy something, so it's, you know, you can't trust them completely either.
Sounds like we don't trust anybody.
Let's probably just start with don't trust anybody except the beauty brains.
We have trust issues.
We do. I think it's just the nature of being a scientist, right? Because it's so funny. Like even in other industry and topics and stuff, I look at like gas, right? They have the expensive gas and the cheap gas. And I'm like, does that octane thing really, that just sounds like a marketing number. Is it really going to affect my car? So I always get the cheapest gas. Meh, sorry.
Oh, goodness. Well, we'll work on our trust issues this year.
We will. All right, our next question.
Dear Valerie and Perry, I love your podcast. Well, except for that episode with the creepy AI voices.
What?
I always listen to the end so I can hear the cat meows and Perry saying kittens. Okay, here are my big questions. What makes a hair conditioner condition? What ingredients should we look for? Are some ingredients more pricey and worth it? I have very fine hair that knots up at night. I'd get a satin pillow, but I think my cat Izzy would let her nails get caught in it. Besides a conditioner, I have to use detanglers even if I'm not shampooing. What's a good detangling agent? Thank you so much for your informative and amusing show. Chris in Battle Creek, Michigan. P.S. When Perry grows his hair to his butt, we'll be he posting a picture for us.
When that happens, I will. But if that happens, which I hope it doesn't, that means my wife doesn't have influence over my hair anymore. So that would probably be a bad thing. Well, thanks for that question, Chris. Hair conditioners. Now, this is something that I spend a lot of time on this. In In 2005, I had the most shampooed head in America because mostly I was working on making a new conditioner. And so I had to wash my hair, try a conditioner prototype, wash my hair again, try.
Yeah, you got to wash it out. Yeah. For me, I never, I would only get it done once because I have such long hair. You're lucky that your hair was so short you could do that. But they would do it once, blow dry it, and then, you know, they're like, all right, go back to the lab.
Yeah, it would take a long time for you to evaluate as many prototypes as I did in the lab with your hair.
Well, the good news is you can split my hair up into or six sections.
Mm-hmm. Sure, yeah, that can work too. Yeah, that's good. All right, on to the conditioner. Hair conditioners, basically what you do with a hair conditioner is you want to leave a film on the fibers, and that's going to help the comb slide past the fibers. It's going to help stop detangling, and it's going to make it look feel smoother, and if you have the right kind of coating, it'll reflect light more, and so that makes it shinier. So all kinds of good stuff with this coating. Now the coatings, you don't want it to be too thick because it'll build up on your hair and it'll look matted down. So there's a fine line. You just want a thin film coating, and the way we do that are with ingredients like cationic surfactants. We can mention some of those. Cationic polymers and silicones. Those are the main three ingredients.
Yeah, I pick a talk to do every year, and I kind of do the circuit with it. And last year my talk was on formulation strategies for conditioning hair, because there is a distinct strategy to making sure that you can condition hair. And it's not just throwing these cationic agents in. Right. As Perry mentioned, there's other ingredients that you would want to put in. And really the goal is to lubricate the hair fiber with an appropriate lubricant for the hair type, to add a conditioning agent that's cationic to help go through the hair, and then making sure you're also using the right shampoo with it, because the shampoo can play a role in how the conditioner performs. And when we're talking about lubricating agents, these are typically oils, silicones. They have different heavinesses, they have different lightnesses. Some of them just help when the hair is wet and you're running your hands through your hair under the water. Some of them aid when the hair is dry. So it really depends which one is in there. For the cationic conditioning agents, there are a few that we can guide you to. They have different properties, though. When I would hire chemists into my lab in my previous role, that everyone thought they could make a shampoo or a conditioner, and so they would just throw polyquaternium 7 in a shampoo and cetrimonium chloride into a conditioner and call it a day. Well, the problem is this actually makes a great economic shampoo, more like what you would see in a hotel chain, to be honest, but it doesn't make a great shampoo, and this is because cetrimonium chloride is great at what we call wet comb. So when your hair is wet, cetrimonium chloride is the perfect detangling agent for when you're in the shower or when you step out of the shower and you want to get a comb through your hair. Yeah. But it doesn't offer any lubrication or cushion on the hair whatsoever. It almost disappears into the hair. On the contrary, you can have something like olealconium chloride or behene trimonium chloride. These you can definitely feel on the hair. And they're okay at wet comb, but they're really good at the dry comb and dry feel and wet feel. These are conditioning agents you actually feel on the hair. So as a formulator, you should be using a couple different conditioning agents to make sure, sure the hair can comb really well and detangle when wet, which is what makes a good detangling agent. So if you're trying to detangle your hair when wet, I would look for a cetrimonium chloride. But if you want your hair to feel good, if you want to feel this coating, I would look for a behene trimonium chloride, a behene trimonium methosulfate. On the contrary, if you have very fine hair, they might be too heavy for you. So you have to look for maybe even a stearamidopropyl dimethylamine. That's a very lightweight conditioning agent. It's very good at wet comb, dry comb, wet feel, and dry feel is what we call it. So those are the conditioning agents I probably would look for. And then going back to the shampoo aspect, you know, make sure you're using a shampoo that is great for your hair type. If you have really fine hair that knots up, I probably would avoid shampoos that have diacyl glucoside or lauryl glucoside in them.
Right.
I find that they tend to be very matting for fine hair.
And there's some soap-based ones, like those solid bar soap shampoos or potassium cocoate, those kinds of things are not good for fine, thin hair.
No, not at all.
And as far as the detangling, also, you know, it's hard to beat a spray in silicones, you know. And if you don't, if you're worried about buildup, something like a cyclomethicone, as long as you can still get it, that's one of those ingredients that is kind of on the way out. So and the thing about it is it evaporates off of the hair. So you get the benefit of the silicone initially, and then it evaporates off. So there's no buildup. But there's environmental concerns there, so you might not be able to find those very much longer.
No. And then for at nighttime, I would actually look at a way to wrap your hair up so that it's on top of your head. It's not in the way of sleeping, but that it's not going to move around at night. If you can immobilize your hair, maybe even with, you know, like a little satin bonnet or pinning it up on top of your head, that's going to be really helpful to help reduce that tangling. Because once fine hair is knotted up, it's very difficult to undo those little knots. As you know, they just tend to break off. So I would also work on some style techniques with that.
Overall, conditioners are quite important, I think, if you want your hair to look and feel the best it can. If you have shorter hair, it's not as concerning, but I still like to condition every day anyway, even because it does make your hair feel better.
Yeah, and sometimes I actually condition first. When I'm shampooing, because I do have long hair, and while it is the texture of male leg hair and doesn't knot super easily, sometimes because it's so long, it just gets really, you know, gross in the shower. So I'll actually put conditioner on the middle to the ends of my hair first, and then shampoo the base, and then just take the remnant conditioner and put it on the top of my hair. And sometimes that helps too.
How about we move on to our next question from Kales? Is epidermal growth factor worth the hype? Epidermal growth factor. Now, this is a skincare ingredient. The idea is that there's these EGFs or peptides and protein change that are ostensibly meant to accelerate cellular wound healing and other biochemical effects. And whenever you see something has an impact on skin cells, the skin marketers get this idea that, oh, that would make a good active ingredient. And sometimes it does, but as far as this EGF goes, if they do work in skincare and skin cells, they are meant to either boost collagen or elastin production and in that way maintain youthful skin.
Well, there's no doubt that these have benefit in skin. There's plenty of literature out there to support that EGF and even keratin growth factors, if you're talking about hair, do have mechanisms within skin. The question is it really doing anything in your skincare when topically applied? Can it get down into the dermis? Can it survive in a skincare formulation? I would say, you know, the answer to that is probably not really. And let's say it really did work. You would be making a drug claim. And in fact, the FDA slapped a Beverly Hills skincare brand from a celebrity dermatologist because he promoted and used EGF in his products. And the FDA said, well, you're making drug claims. You know, you absolutely can't do that. And what's interesting about that story is I actually was a tester for that product line. This was before I was in the cosmetics industry. Wow. And I was a paid evaluator. So I would go to this office and get pictures of my skin taken and then get the creams to take. And then that's why I distinctly remember this FDA warning letter.
Yeah. Well, a lot of the dermatologists do kind of skate the line because at some level, they're doctors, right? They are doctors. And then when they are prescribing something, they can make it seem like there's like this medical care grade skincare, which is different, but it's not really. It's when it comes down to it, it's still cosmetics. And EGFs, they are interacting with your cells. And if something is going to interact with your cells and cause biochemical changes to your body, that becomes a drug. It's not no longer a cosmetic, which is only supposed to affect the appearance of your skin and not in any kind of permanent way.
Yeah. So are they worth the hype? I don't think so. Also, you know, they're very expensive, so it's hard to use, you know, I don't even know what a meaningful level is, but they're very expensive. So I would also imagine there's not much in the product, or because most of the work is done in medical literature, they're not looking at use levels and efficacy. So it's kind of hard to say, is your product really supporting efficacy?
I wonder if you use them with microneedle patches.
You know, probably, actually.
Yeah, probably. There should be a study done. I wonder why that hasn't happened.
Yeah, well, maybe, or maybe we've prompted some great ideas.
Well, often the reason a study hasn't been done is it has been done and it just ended up in somebody's file cabinet because it didn't work. So
Or
we'll
because you
see.
have to have someone pay for the work, right? People just aren't working for free. So someone has to support it.
Absolutely. All right, we have time for one more question, and this one comes to us from Renee. Renee says, "Hey, I was checking out the ingredients in my hair products and noticed they've got stuff like avocado oil, chrysanthemum extract, aloe juice, and other cool extracts that they don't really talk about. Why wouldn't a brand hype up these ingredients to make their products seem even better? Thanks for your show." Well, this is interesting question. There are a lot of brands that'll put a huge ingredient list with all kinds of ingredients, and they never say anything about those ingredients. And it is kind of confusing to a consumer.
It is. And I guess the question here is, how did all these ingredients end up in the product, and why aren't brands talking about it if that's the case?
Right.
And I'd like to think this is for a couple of reasons. One, when I formulate a product, I learned from the school of design that less is more, and I'm a minimalist formulator. And
Right.
now it's trending and everyone's talking about it, but that's how I was taught. So I didn't use anything in the formula if it didn't have some kind of point or doing something. And, you know, a lot of the times it was functional, and then sometimes I would have to appease marketing and put their star marketing extract in. So you didn't find a lot of stuff. But there are formulators that come from another school of thought that more is more.
Right.
And so a formulator will load up a shampoo or conditioner with 20, 25, or 30 ingredients, and some of them are efficacious, some of them are in there because they like the sound or they love the marketing story. And the marketing team might only latch on to a couple of them because there's really only so much you can talk about with a conditioner, right?
Right.
Usually, or a skincare product. Usually you have 3 to 4, maybe 3 to 5 star ingredients that you're going to feature, and the rest you just don't. So the other things that were put in are set by the wayside. The other thing is perhaps this is a what we'll call a private label formula, or a formula that a contract manufacturer already made, and they're using it for the brand. And it had a bunch of other stuff in it, and the brand says, well, I really wanted to use avocado oil. So the
Right.
manufacturer will just toss in avocado oil on top of it to appease the customer. So again, you have all these ingredients that are listed on the label, but you know, none of them are really there to be talked about.
It's a more efficient way for the manufacturer to just have stock formulas, which they can just dump some new thing in. But they're going to also want to have a few feature ingredients just in case a customer, you know, doesn't want to add anything more to the formula, and that because everything you add is going to add a little bit of expense. So it's just an efficiency in manufacturing.
Yeah, that's a great point. The last thing I want to point out is sometimes a brand can't talk about an ingredient because there's not enough in there for it to be talked about. So, for example, this chrysanthemum extract, maybe it's on the label for some reason, who knows? And they say, wow, I really want to say it does these things. And their regulatory counsel might say, well, you know, you couldn't even find it if you put it in a
Right.
chrysanthemum detector. So, you know, probably best to avoid saying the formula is doing these things because of it. So I would say for that reason, maybe they're skipping it. Or something like aloe juice is, you know, it's very consumer dependent. Natural circles really love to know that aloe juice is in their hair products. Other
Right.
people don't really care.
Right. And so you put it in there for those people who do care. And you don't have to talk about it because the people who care will look at the label and find it. The other thing that I see is this also gives the maximum flexibility to the marketing people. So if they want to talk about one marketing season, they want to talk about how great the avocado oil is for their product, that's good. If a year later the avocado oil story isn't working so well, now they can start talking about the aloe story without having to change the product, and that's just more efficient. So the more stories you can give to the marketing people, the easier it is for them to sell the products, which is ultimately why you add all these ingredients.
Yeah, and I don't want to say marketing doesn't know. I mean, they definitely know what consumers are interested in for sure. But when it comes to actually putting a formula together, marketing might say, oh, we want avocado oil. And as the chemist, yeah, I've got a little, right, you know, set of ingredients I really love. So I might say, okay, well, they want avocado oil, but if they want this effect in hair, they really got to use this other oil. And right, so maybe you'll slip both of them in, and that way they'll have the flexibility down the road. Yeah. But you also got to put your personal flair on the product.
That's my personal flair was always to put a 0.44 somewhere in my formula. So.
Oh, my gosh.
You could always tell Romanowski because there was a 0.44 somewhere in that formula.
Oh, my gosh. That's crazy. I didn't know that.
I always prefer the term eccentric.
Oh, goodness. I hear music.
You do. Well, thanks, everybody. I see the sun coming out, so it's time to hit the beach after finishing this show.
Oh, wow. That sounds good right now.
Well, thanks for listening, everyone.
If you get a chance, head over to Apple Podcasts and leave us a review. That's going to help other people find the show and ensure we have a full docket of beauty questions to answer.
And if you have a question, you can just record it on your smartphone and email it to thebeautybrains@gmail.com, and we can play your question on the show instead of using AI-generated voices. Unless you say we can do that, then we might do that too. Hey, you know, the Beauty Brains are also on Patreon. If you like what we do and the fact that we don't have advertisements in it in the show, then you can help continue to support us by going to patreon.com/thebeautybrains and subscribe. And if you do that, you do get higher priority of your questions answered, and you get a transcript of the show.
Also, follow us on our various social media accounts. On Instagram, we're at thebeautybrains2018. On X, we're at thebeautybrains. And we have a Facebook page plus a TikTok.
TikTok. And we're trying to we're not going to try to induce tweens to go to Sephora and act crazy.
No, but maybe we could talk about our rage about it.
We could. Well, thanks for listening, everyone.
And remember, be brainy about your beauty.
Thanks, everyone.
Kittens.